cause number 13-19-412-CV, Monsignor Michael Eras versus the Diocese of Corpus Christi and Bishop William Michael Mulvey, consolidated with cause number 13-19-413-CV, Father John Feminelli versus the Diocese of Corpus Christi and Bishop William Michael Mulvey.
I'm Andrew Greenwell here for the appellants, Monsignor Eras and Father Feminelli. I'd like 20 minutes total, 15 for my opening and 5 for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Audrey Vickner on behalf of the appellees, the Diocese of Corpus Christi, and Bishop William Michael Mulvey. We would like to have 20 minutes, please. Thank you.
Okay. And can both counsel see the clock?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So that will be how you will monitor your time. All right, then. With those introductions set, we will begin. So, Mr. Greenwell, please proceed with your argument.
All right. Thank you very much. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Andrew Greenwell, and I represent, as I said before, Father Feminelli and Monsignor Eras, who are here appealing a dismissal on the grounds of jurisdiction based on the doctrine of ecclesial abstention. I'd like to go over three things in my argument. The first is the standard of review, which is shouldn't be very, it's not controversial at all. And then I'd like to go over and discuss the kind of unique features about this case that take it out of all the cases that the diocese is relying on in order to support Justice's decision to dismiss on the grounds of jurisdiction. And then I'd like to discuss the two cases that I think are operative in terms of giving guidance to this court, and that is the Patton versus Jones case, as well as the Diocese of Lubbock case, which is now pending before the Supreme Court of Texas on a mandamus, and no ruling as of yesterday has been done on that court. With respect to the standard of review, it's pretty straightforward. On a plea to the jurisdiction, the person who's advocating the plea, in this case, the diocese or Bishop Mulvey, has the burden of proof. In a plea to the jurisdiction where evidence has been introduced, which is what happened in this case, the standard of review, both for the trial court and the appellate court, is identical to a summary judgment standard. That is to say that all the facts that are in evidence are taken in favor of the person who's defending the plea, and any inferences in his favor and any contradicting or conflicting evidence, the conflict is ignored and benefit of the doubt is given to, in this case, my clients. And so in substance, Bishop Mulvey and the diocese have the burden of proof, and all the standard of review is in my favor. With respect to the law, of course, we're dealing with a de novo issue. Now, I think what's important in terms of looking at this issue, which is before this court, is to recognize what's involved, because the courts, the opinions that are out there that give us guidance talk about these sorts of things. And I have a little blow up. It's kind of a Venn diagram. I hope you all can see it. Can y'all see that? Can read it? Is it reversed?
Mm-hmm. No, we see it. We can see it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right. Basically, it's a Venn diagram, and what it intends to show is that there's kind of four things that we should look at. The first is whether we have a purely ecclesiastical matter, or we have a purely civil tort, or we have a criminal situation. And in this particular situation, we have a blending where Monsignor Eras and Father Feminelli are right there in the middle, where they're in an overlapping position. So what we're involved here is not a purely ecclesiastical matter, not a criminal matter, and not purely a civil matter, but we have a situation where all three are combined. And what I mean by that is that they have been accused, defamed in a public forum, that is to say publicly with media announcement and media help and the help of the internet as well, and the public posting. They have been defamed and accused of being credibly accused of sexual abuse of a minor. Sexual abuse of a minor is not a purely ecclesiastical situation. We're not dealing with whether or not Monsignor Eras believes in the Trinity or whether Father Feminelli believes in priestly celibacy. We're not dealing with issues that deal with ecclesiastical governance, ecclesiastical rules, doctrine, and so forth.
Mr. Greenwell, except as you all know, what Ms. McNair or what the diocese is arguing is that the decision to publish the list of those names is based on the charter, which is ecclesiastical. And so we are to look at the broad protection that is provided by the law.
I understand that. And if it were simply a matter of internal discipline, I don't think that would be a problem. The problem is that however they got there, they publicly announced that my clients were credibly accused of a criminal offense under the laws of the state of Texas, which causes a problem because that's not a normal ecclesiastical situation. What you have here then is them being accused of a criminal offense under Texas law, something more than just what we call a canonical delict or a canonical crime. We're dealing with a criminal offense under the laws of the state of Texas. So that's different from most situations.
But how can your case be prosecuted, or how can it go forward without delving into the charter and the reasons behind the diocese decision to do this?
Well, I'm not sure that it can. Any decision has to be looked at in terms of discovery. So that's no different from any other sort of case. We have to establish our motive. We have to establish whether it was reasonable. We have to establish malice. And obviously, we have to look at documents and communications and so forth. But those aren't necessarily at all different from any other defamation case. In any other defamation case against a corporation, for example, you would be entitled to see the same things. And the procedures of the corporation aren't necessarily instrumental or operative as to whether there was a defamation or not, because defamation is based on what the reasonable member of the public would recognize or would understand credibly accused of sexual abuse of a minor to be. And so it takes you outside of the strictly jurisdictional questions, because it's what does the public believe these things mean? And the public would take the understanding of what was published, credible accusations of sexual abuse of a minor, and understand them the way they understand them to be, which is that it's an heinous offense, and it's a crime under Texas law. And not only that, it's a tort, and it's a per se negligence. I mean, a per se defamation case, because it's accusing somebody of potentially having committed a criminal offense under the laws of the state of Texas. So we have something that's a tort, something that's an accusation of a crime, something that is a crime to every member of the human community. And so we don't have a strictly and solely ecclesiastical issue dealing with ecclesial governance. We have something that's blended. And that's why if you look at cases where you don't have this blending, you will overemphasize the first immunity, the First Amendment immunity, and you will essentially give the diocese an absolute sovereign immunity over defamation cases, which the First Amendment is not intended ever to protect a bishop or any member of the clergy from torts, from civil torts. You are still liable under the criminal law for crimes that you commit. You are still liable, regardless of the First Amendment, of torts that you have committed. So I think we're in a situation which is remarkably different from every one of the cases that's relied on by the diocese and the church. The two cases that we rely on are Patton versus Jones. Patton versus Jones involved a youth minister. Actually, the facts in that case resulted in the plea to the jurisdiction being sustained. But what's important about that case is that case, in its holding, gave us the standards, at least for the Austin Court of Appeals, as to what should be looked at in the situation of a defamation claim. In that case, there were two claims that were being made. One had to do with the employment, and that falls under the ministerial exception rules, which are entirely different and really don't apply to how you analyze a defamation claim. In this particular case, we have a defamation claim, and in that case, that was an alternative claim as well. And the court there gave three elements that had to be conclusively proved by the diocese or by the church, whatever it might be, in order to be entitled to this ecclesiastical immunity and therefore the abstention. It had the claim had to flow entirely from the employment dispute. The publication of the supposedly defamatory statement had to be confined within the church, and then there would be no unusual or egregious circumstances that's involved that would be an exception to the general rule. So those three elements would have had to be proved if Patton versus Jones is to be followed, and I don't think there's any question under the standard of review that's appropriate that the diocese not only didn't prove those conclusively, but in fact they're conclusively established to the other one, to the opposite. And we showed how the claim of defamation has nothing to do with the employment status of these two priests. The time difference between those issues shows that there's no relationship to it. Our claim shows no relationship to it. We have no employment claims that are pending. It's a purely defamatory claim arising from the publication that occurred on January 31st, 2019. The publication was clearly not confined within the church. There was a plan by Bishop Mulvey, implemented by him, ordered by him to have media publications. And then not only was it publicly advertised, so to speak, in the media, but it was publicly allowed and given access to the media. And then Bishop Mulvey went and actually talked about it to the media, to the Corpus Christi Caller Times and to the...
But counsel, wasn't the only... It was posted, my understanding is, in a church website. It wasn't published outside when all the conversations that the bishop had was in regards to the policy of the church, etc. But the actual list was only included in the diocese website. Is that correct?
The list itself was initially published in the diocesan website, but before it was published, there was a media event given. There were media releases so that everybody was warned that it was coming, and they would have access to it. There was no effort to limit the publication to the church, and then after that, the list was publicized by Bishop Mulvey going to the media. So this is not just purely a publication on the website. This is not like the JS case where they published some defamatory statements that were only available to those who were members. In this case, there was no restriction as to who could see it. In addition, it was reasonably foreseeable that the list would be published and then republished. And you are responsible under the law of defamation for the republication that's reasonably foreseeable. And in the deposition that we took of Bishop Mulvey, he admitted that it was reasonably foreseeable to him that the statements that he would make and the list that he would promulgate would be taken up by the media and republished, and therefore he is responsible for the publication outside the confines of the church.
And that is an issue that is discussed in the Lubbock case, that's very similar to this one. My thoughts, just housekeeping matter, is this matter is pending already before the Supreme Court, and my thoughts are, wouldn't you think it would be advisable to just abate this case until we had a ruling from the higher court, as opposed to conceivably having a contradictory finding in to our sister court? Wouldn't the prudent thing to do would be to just abate this matter until we hear from what they're going to do, the Supreme Court's going to do in the Lubbock matter?
I don't know if an abatement, a formal abatement, is warranted, but I would agree with you that in terms of judicial resources, it would make sense to await what the Supreme Court does. Obviously, if the Supreme Court affirms the Amarillo Court of Appeals, it seems to me that there's very, very little, if anything, certainly no important distinction between our situation and the situation that's before then. And I think that that would be binding authority, binding precedent for this court to consider. If the Supreme Court does not decide anything and they just basically decide not to exercise their discretion, then you got the Amarillo case to rely on. And obviously if they reverse the Amarillo opinion, well then that will probably bind this court as well. So yes, it would make sense to maybe delay, but I don't know if an official abatement is warranted, but in terms of y'all's allocation of resources and the decision as to when to write the opinion, it would make sense to me, if I were in your shoes, to look at that.
How long has it been pending? It's
there's two cases up there. One is an appeal, because there's both an appeal and a mandamus. The appeal happened, I think, January 21st of this year. The mandamus, I think, March 18th, if my recollection is correct. So there's still time. I mean, it'll be a few months, I would think, by the end of the month, by the end of the summer, you might have some decision as to whether they're going to exercise the discretionary mandamus jurisdiction or not. And so,
Is the appeal on the matter with regard to the anti-SLAPP statute and not the jurisdiction matter?
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yes, I believe that's how it is. The important issue for us in terms of this case is the mandamus. I believe the mandamus is right on point with respect to the First Amendment matters.
Just to distinguish that case a little bit, that involved, I believe, a 41-year-old person that was the alleged victim, I guess, if you would use that word, in that case. But why would that distinguish it? I mean, here we do have at least two or three, both of these parties that you represent, there had been prior public allegations made against these two individuals. Isn't that correct? Wouldn't that distinguish the Lubbeck case, being that if there was a defamation or statements made, it's not anything that it would be quote unquote new to the public? Would that be a distinction, or can you speak to that?
I don't think that was a distinction that was made. I think the deacon in that case, it had been publicized as well. So I don't think that's an issue. And the court really didn't look at it that way. The issue in that case, it seemed to me, was involved as on the accusation itself, the defamation, because the deacon in that case, Guerrero, was accused of sexual abuse of a minor, and the purported victim was a woman who had mental issues, and she was considered a minor under canon law, and for that reason he got brought into the list. That really wasn't an operative fact, it seems to me, in that case, and so I don't think it's a big difference. But here we have something similar, and that is that the definition that Bishop Mulvey used would involve things that are not sexual abuse of a minor, as we normally understand the term, grooming or possible problems, imprudent actions by the priest, and not any actions that would be actionable under the criminal law or would be considered under by any member of the public as sexual abuse of a minor. And for that reason, there's kind of a similar thing. In that case, it involved the definition of who a minor is, and in our case, it involves what credible evidence of sexual abuse is. So I don't see that as being a big enough factor to change the applicability of the Lubbeck Court of Appeals and its pivotal nuances. It seems to me that we fall exactly under the same situation. In fact, it was the same process that was used by and suggested by the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops and the Lubbeck Diocese followed is what they followed here. So I don't see the distinction.
Thank you.
I'm out of time.
We'll have your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, on behalf of the Diocese of Corpus Christi and the bishop, we're pleased to be here this morning to present the arguments for the diocese. Let's start from the top, which is the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops and the charter that they promulgated almost 20 years ago for the protection of young people and children. The whole purpose of this is to protect the children. This is about the children. It's not about the priests now. It's about the children. This is the governing document, this charter, for dioceses throughout the United States, let alone dioceses throughout Texas. These are the rules. These are the regulations. These are the way the dioceses are to manage their affairs when it comes to how to handle sexual abuse of minors by priests within the diocese. This is purely ecclesiastical because the purpose of this is to create transparency and to further transparency within the church on this issue, which had been lacking for a long time, also to restore faith in the church where it had been lost, and again to recognize the children and the victims and to ask others to come forward who may not have yet made their situations known. Now, the appellants and their counsel throughout their filings in this case have made it very clear how they really feel about the diocese, about the Catholic Church for that matter, in the way they are now handling this long-stemming problem within the church. They've been vitriolic about it at times, and that really highlights why everything about this case is ecclesiastical at its core. In 1872, the United States Supreme Court handed down Watson versus Jones. They told us four categories that are considered strictly and purely ecclesiastical. And I'm going to go through each one of them. But this
before you do, Ms. McNair, I have two questions. First of all, with regard to the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops, who determined to publish this list, according to your brief, the bishops decided to publish the list because it was the underlying intent of the charter for them to do so. Does the charter in any place say that this action should have taken place? And did it happen anywhere other than Texas? The publication of the list.
Does the charter in any place say to publish the list?
That could be one of the acts that they should be following in order to accomplish the objectives of the charter.
Publish
the list of those that are credibly accused. And did it happen anywhere other than Texas?
The charter very clearly states that churches are to be transparent. The diocese are to inform their members with respect to sexual abuse of minors within their diocese, and the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops acted accordingly. The express provisions of the charter are in our brief. The charter is also attached as an appendix. Right off the top of my head, the provision in the charter, I can't cite to you at this moment, maybe it's 7, 8, or 9, but they're very clear about the fact that they should be public in their disclosure, because again, that goes to the transparency. They want the diocese to be transparent. So the Texas Catholic Conference, after the charter was amended in 2018, the Texas Catholic Conference came together and determined that pursuant to the charter and all of these policies that were in place, they were going to, all 15 dioceses around the state of Texas were going to publish their lists on the same date. As I understand it, most of them did so. And that can be seen in the record too from some of the publications that we have. We know obviously Lubbock did so, but we understand many, many other dioceses did so. And it's not in the record, but I understand that dioceses throughout the United States have been publishing lists, okay, all pursuant to the charter.
So the second question I have then is, as you emphasized that the purpose behind this was transparency. And I find a little troublesome here is they're saying that this is, they're being transparent by doing so, yet they don't want the process itself to be transparent. They want to keep all of that secret. The use of this, you know, panel, this independent panel, I mean, being secret, with all due respect here, is what caused this problem to begin with. It was a problem with the church, the way they were moving these priests around and keeping it hush hush, and so that was a big part of the problem to begin with. So it seems a little inconsistent here that they're now saying, oh, we're going to be transparent, but we don't want you to know, you know, how we're going about this.
Well, and I understand the court's concern, but I think you can only go so far, because the United States Constitution protects the church. It protects freedom of association. It protects freedom of exercise. You've also got Watson versus Jones, which protects these four areas that we're going to talk about. There's only so far you can go. We know from the Fifth Circuit decision in Whole Woman's Health that churches are allowed to get in the public square, advocate their position on political or serious moral issues without having their internal workings interfered with. We know from Watson versus Jones, let's talk about these four areas. You've got theological controversy, which means a controversy in the study of religious faith and in practice and in exercise. So in this case, we've got theological controversy by virtue of this long history of sexual abuse of minors by priests. The appellants are creating a theological controversy because they don't like the way the Catholic Church is handling the issue. Then you've got the fact that sexual abuse of a minor is defined by the charter, by the governing, managing document. And I'm going to read the definition because you can see you can't apply secular terms to this. It's defined as a delict against the sixth commandment of the Decalogue committed by a cleric with a minor below the age of 18 years.
But that's not how the reasonable person out in the public would understand that. When they see this publication and they see that they've been credibly accused of this offense, people aren't understanding it that way with that definition.
Well, again, the bishop was communicating with the members of the diocese. he's communicating to the members of the church, and so he's telling them. And you, when you read these communications, when you read his written statement online on the diocese website to the people of God of Corpus Christi, and when you read the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops discussions and all of their letters, all of this says, please pray for us. Please, you know, please continue to practice your faith. We need to join together as a church. And freedom of exercise and freedom of association permits, requires that no church can get involved in the practice of faith. No court can get involved in the way a church manages itself, the rules and regulations it puts on its members, for lack of a better word, rules and regulations. You cannot use secular terms to try to go in and pick apart a definition of a rule that's been pronounced by the church with its internal workings.
Then that why a press release? Why do a press release? Because clearly they had to know that it was going to get picked up, as you have, you know, said in your brief, and as the trial court said, it just happened to get picked up. That has no control of the church. They had to have known it was going to get picked up. This was big news.
Well, and to your point that it was big news, yes, I guess they would know it would get picked up. But again, that doesn't, just because it's left the walls of the church doesn't mean that the church loses all its freedoms. If we do that, now we have chilled the mission of the church. And again, remember what the mission is here. It's the protection of the children and the protection of young people. That is the sole mission of this. And also transparency and to restore faith. All of these purely ecclesiastical issues. The press release, Your Honor, was months ahead of the list. No appellant's name, no priest's name, no name was put on that list. The press release is directed to the people of God of Corpus Christi. There's also the Texas Catholic Conference announcement that's attached that makes very clear that all 15 dioceses around the state of Texas have determined that they need to publish these lists for these ecclesiastical reasons. They also talk about, that announcement talks about how there are policies and procedures in place that all the dioceses are following. And there is nothing in the appellant's live pleading that says that anything about that press release was defamatory. The allegations of defamation are solely based on what happened on January 31st, 2019, and that's it. Nothing, the press release does not form the basis of their claims. So we would submit that that press release is really a red herring, quite frankly, because in particular, it's not a basis of the appellant's claims. And again, we're dealing with a pure theological controversy here about is the church handling this properly or not? No court can interfere with that. Another area that Watson versus Jones says we cannot tread on is discipline of the clergy. You could say that inclusion on this list of clerics credibly accused of sexual abuse of a minor is a form of discipline. It was also required by the charter, again, the managing document for the diocese. No court can interfere with that either. The appellants are contending they were improperly disciplined. That's off the books. They cannot do that.
But counsel, this occurred years after the allegations were brought to the attention of the diocese. I could see that argument being valid if the church had conducted an investigation internally and had determined there was credible reasons to believe that these people were involved in improper actions and then divulged it. But I guess the question that I have in my mind, and I think that also the Lubbock court had, was this distance in time from the act to the publication or to the dissemination of this information. You know, I guess, you know, how would you respond to that?
Well, the list was published to the members of the diocese based upon a decision that the Texas Catholic Conference made the fall before, so September of 2018 or so. That decision was made based upon a revision to the charter in 2018 as well. I mean, all of this is coming down based upon the rules and the guidelines for the management of these dioceses in how to handle this issue. So again, the Diocese of Corpus Christi, and this is in the record, the Diocese of Corpus Christi is bound by the charter, they're governed by the charter, and they proceed according to the charter. And so that's what the Diocese of Corpus Christi was doing. To the extent that there's some gap in time, for instance, with Feminelli, the allegations against him were back in the 80s. And we know, go ahead.
But on that point, Counselor, how can you say that this is discipline of the clergy when both of these guys had not been priests or clerics for quite some time? So if you're going to apply the Watson standard, isn't it a fallacy because they cannot discipline people who are not within their purview?
Well, what I'm suggesting is this, as I said, it's akin to a discipline. And these are four areas of Watson. If we decide that the discipline doesn't, if you believe that that does not apply, then we would submit that theological controversy, ecclesiastical government, and standard of morals required of the priests are the three other areas that would apply. I hear what you're saying, and I did say that it was akin to a discipline, and that is one facet of this analysis. If we get to ecclesiastical government, that is the government of the church as an institution. Again, that's all coming down from the charter. That's coming from the United States Conference through the Texas Conference down to our own bishop here in Corpus Christi. The rules and regulations were in place. We had an independent panel who looked at all of these files and determined who had been credibly accused of sexual abuse of a minor. And if they had been determined to be so, the bishop put them on the list. And this is all internal government of the diocese. And the publication of the list, too, again, is based on...
But Ms. McNair, by using an independent panel, these were four, as I understand it, lawyers in the community. Were they members of the diocese?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. They are confidential.
Okay.
The Diocese of Corpus Christi was permitted to and did keep the members confidential. And considering here we are having an oral argument on this issue, you can imagine why they might want to be confidential. But, you know,
point is, if they're an independent panel, I'm assuming sure. They were not members of the diocese for purposes of my little hypothetical that I'm going to give you here. Let's say that those four lawyers that were asked to review all these files...
Yes.
Not
yes.
members of the diocese. Obviously, they were not part of the church in terms of employed by the church in any way.
Right.
Right there, the church is taking it outside of the diocese and including people that are not part of their governance. Let's say, as a hypothetical, that these four independent people have an axe to grind with these priests for some reason or another, and you know they want to defame them. They have an ulterior motive. And in that instance, so you're saying that the protections afforded under the ecclesiastical doctrine then should extend to them as well?
Well, part of the problem is, Your Honor, now we're getting into the internal workings of the church where we cannot go. We cannot go there. So we can't make a lot of these assumptions. There's nothing in the record that there's anything untoward about the independent panel. No one has suggested that whatsoever.
I understand that. That was simply a hypothetical in terms of how far does this doctrine reach? It's a very broad doctrine, obviously. And my question is, if the church chooses to go outside of its boundaries, does the protection extend to them as well?
Well, one of the cases that's cited in the briefing, and the name of it is escaping me at this moment, I think it's an old Louisiana case that actually Mr. Greenwell cited, talked about the fact that that church, based upon its governing documents, used an independent panel as well to determine whether or not accusations against someone for sexual abuse were proper or not. And they talked about the fact that that panel was protected. And so we would suggest to you that this panel is likewise protected for all of the reasons that you are now getting into the core of the internal workings of this church. The free exercise clause allows the church to determine the standard of morals required of its priests. That's where, and the charter comes in for that too. We've got the canon law. And I just want to read to you, because Mr. Greenwell has spent a significant amount of time talking about Texas criminal law. This case isn't about Texas criminal law, it's about canon law and it's about the charter. And so the charter says that sexual abuse of a minor is a crime in the universal law of the church. And as I read to you earlier, it's a delict against the sixth commandment of the Decalogue. We brought forward an affidavit from the chancellor of the diocese, Benedict Wynn, who broke the definition down using canon law. And so he says a delict is a canonical crime. A canonical crime against the sixth commandment means any sexual sin. Therefore, sexual abuse of a minor is any sexual sin committed by a cleric with a minor. And the bishop did testify that that's very broad. He said that can be grooming, that can be touching, it's very broad. We cannot apply secular definitions.
And counsel, was that definition part of the press release or part of the of the definition when it was disseminated to the diocese or to the members of the diocese, so they would know what the church construed as inappropriate conduct, or I guess credibly accused, what that meant, as opposed to the general understanding of what the public might have of what abuse consists of.
Well, Your Honor, the statements by the bishop to the members of the Corpus Christi Diocese does not reference the charter, but the bishop's allowed to talk to the members of his church. That's considered inside the walls of the church. Anything that goes on there, that's protected. I mean, he's speaking to his members. Now, the fact that the media and the parties stipulated to this, the media picked it up and published it. It is not true that the diocese actually published this list to the media. That did not happen. There is no evidence of that. I know that that's been an implication in this case and an inference. There is no evidence that the bishop named any priest, let alone any appellant, during any conversation with any media. There's no evidence of even what happened with any conversation with the media, except for one reference to transparency. And again, ecclesiastical, one of the main missions of the church, that we do not want to chill here. Remember, one of the big issues with building into this, if you want to peel back the layers of the onion on this case, what are you doing? At base, the whole purpose of the First Amendment is to make sure that we don't chill the church's exercise. We don't chill the church's freedom of association. We want the church to be able to continue with its values. We want the church to be able to let others know what those values are. People within the church conduct their lives accordingly, and that's very important. I want to say, we're going to run out of time. Patton versus Jones does not apply to this case. Patton versus Jones deals with the ministerial exception. That's employment decisions. Mr. Greenwell's made very clear, and they say in their pleadings, this is not an employment decision case. Patton versus Jones is from 2006. No mention of a charter, no mention of sexual abuse of a minor. None of that was involved.
But wasn't it relied on in the Lubbock case?
It was relied on in the Lubbock case, Your Honor, and we would submit that was improperly done. We would submit that the Lubbock case, there's quite a few significant concerns about the opinion in the Lubbock case, which is, as Mr. Greenwell stated, on review in the Supreme Court by mandamus. Multiple Amici briefs have been filed in that case, including from the Jewish Coalition, the Baptist Convention, the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops, and interestingly, about 35 members of the Texas legislators. The Texas legislators brief talks about all of the legislative policy in this state, which is sort of run amok by the Lubbock opinion. You've got the freedom to worship publicly, the autonomy of religion, also reporting and registering sex offenders and people accused of abusing children. And then, of course, overarching all of it is the public policy in favor of protecting children.
And well, Counselor, but I guess I'll ask you the last question and ask the Chief to give you permission to answer. If this is the Lubbock case, basically, all these people are chiming in with their take and their assertion that it was decided incorrectly, and it's before the Supreme Court. Wouldn't it be the most prudent thing to do to abate this case or to wait on deciding this case until the Supreme Court is able to address this matter instead of us coming in with a possibly contradictory opinion or a concurring opinion?
Well, Your Honor, I understand that economies of scale are important and we don't want to waste judicial resources, but this is a very important case. The diocese, and certainly I would think the appellants, want this case to be decided. The Supreme Court is aware that this case is pending in your court. What the Supreme Court is doing, we don't know. Is the Supreme Court waiting for us? I suppose that's possible. I can't say that that's happening, but that's possible. They know we're here. And so, because our decision is different. Our trial court dismissed. The trial court in Guerrero didn't dismiss. So we're already coming at it from two different places. And we know the court likes to see conflict, and we know like the court likes to decide these things. We also have a very strong record in this case. We do have the charter. We do have all of these communications coming down from the Texas Catholic Conference and the bishop's statements and all of those things that the Lubbock case doesn't necessarily have. And so we would submit that it would be a beneficial thing, I think, to move forward. I agree with Mr. Greenwell, abatement probably wouldn't be necessary. Or, you know, if the court wanted to wait a little while just to see what the Supreme Court does. But eventually, though, we would like to see this court make its own determination. There's some good guiding authority in the briefing in the Supreme Court as it stands while it pens.
Well, you all have both done an excellent job at your briefs. For the record, I think the Louisiana case is the Hayden case. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. McNair. Mr. Greenwell?
Thank you.
I just have a few points with respect to the USCCB and the charter and so forth. I think the one word that I did not hear from opposing counsel was the notion of emblemata. Emblemata is kind of a word that's central. It's a work of art a word that's used in courts in analyzing this First Amendment. What it is, it's a warning to the courts, to the civil courts, that don't get confused just because there's ecclesiastical definitions or ecclesiastical documents or ecclesiastical issues. In other words, it just because there's a charter out there does not mean at all that the First Amendment is implied and they win King's X. That's not at all what it says. In fact, it says be very careful and wary, because simply because there's churchy issues here does not mean the First Amendment applies. You have to have a theological controversy alone, a church discipline matter alone, a ecclesiastical government matter alone, or a conformity with the required standard of discipline for the internal to the church alone. And if you don't have those alone, any one of them or all in a combination, then you don't have a First Amendment issue necessarily. And in this case, that's why it's so important to look at the fact that we don't have these issues alone at all. What we have is a situation where the bishop promoted and published the names of my people and accused them publicly of what everyone in the public believes would be a criminal offense under Texas law, and what is, under the definition of the civil law in Texas, a per se defamation. That's what we have here. And so the fact that the rules may require what happened is irrelevant. And think about it this way. Let's have a hypothetical that's kind of similar. Let us assume that you have the same situations that they're arguing, that there's a theological controversy, that there's a church discipline matter involving government and involving the internal discipline of the church. But the church and all these documents says we want priests to punish corporally their a congregation that does not follow the discipline of the church. And so they punish people corporally, assault them under the terms of the church, under the church's governance, under the requirements of the church. Are you telling me that that church decision to corporally punish people and assault them is protected under the First Amendment? Absolutely not. So the fact that you may have a church making decisions, the moment that it goes outside of church discipline and involves something that the state is interested in, you don't have First Amendment protection anymore. First Amendment protection is solely for the internal workings of the church. And it does not ostracize the state from enforcing its defamation laws. And in here, in Texas in particular, because the defamation claim that we have is constitutionally given to Monsignor Eras and to Father Feminelli. And so it has a constitutional dignity that is not found in other states. So,
but counsel, let me ask you this. Isn't the decision to inform the church members about serious complaints, I'm not talking about that they made a finding that it actually happened, but just the complaints that are made against the clergy, an internal church decision, and how, why should the courts get involved in that kind of internal decision making?
It can be in some situations, but what we're dealing here, what happened on January 31st is that the dioceses were scared to death because of the public perception that they had been involved in a cover-up. What happened was that the Pennsylvania District of Attorney decided to undergo and make an investigation of the Pennsylvania.
But counsel, you're arguing things outside the record, aren't you?
No, I think that's in the record, and that's what caused the Texas Catholic Conference of Bishops to make the decision that they did, and that's why they went to the media to publish this thing before they published the list, to go to the media, and those press releases were given not to members of the church only, but were given to the local media, and Bishop Mulvey admitted that in his deposition. So we have here something a little different. This notion of transparency is not necessarily going to transparency within the church. They're talking about transparency to the public. And it's a public relations issue, and that's why the press was involved. That's why what we're dealing with here is something different than just a mere internal discipline issue where the church makes decisions. They have a committee or some kind of adjudication, and that's where it ends. Here a decision was made to go out of the envelope of the church publicly to accuse my clients of the heinous crime, and for that reason we're just outside of the First Amendment protection under Jones, Patton versus Jones, or under Lubbock, or even under the cases that they rely on, because we're beyond that. If the church were to again do something and that is against the law, either is a civil tort or is against the criminal laws of the state of Texas, there's not a First Amendment in the world that will protect them. This is not, the church is not sovereignly immune. And that's what kind of they're arguing. A sovereign immunity for Bishop Mulvey, so he can defame people publicly without having to answer to the courts of the state of Texas. And that is something that we never want to allow in a state. I mean, we have secular courts with secular laws that will be enforced against anybody. And true, we have the First Amendment, and it applies, and I'm a great advocate of it. I have absolutely no animosity towards the church. I'm a member of the church. But I also recognize that the state has its role in the governments of the citizens of its citizens. I represent two of them. They have been defamed. They have a right under the laws of the state of Texas to go to the civil court for civil relief under the open court system.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Greenwell. And thank you, Ms. McNair. And thank you again for participating, as just as Hinojosa started to say, in the first OA oral argument before the 13th Court of Appeals. The case will be under submission.